accession number 12368, reel 3.
Mr. Clark, reel 3. You just mentioned the Sangro.
Yes. The Sangro was a difficult road across. It was flooded by the Germans, so that we had to approach it by bringing up pontoons and equipment. And there was rather a prolonged fight before we eventually gained the bridges and pushed on further. At that time, which was approaching Christmas 1943, I was called over to the 5th Army Front at Naples. I joined the Garigliano battles and the battle for Cassino. I saw the bombing of the monastery there on a cold January day. In that area, there was some of the fiercest fighting of the war, because, of course, it's extremely hilly, and to gain advantages, steep crags had to be climbed and equipment taken up to them. It was a very cold, wet January, and mud again took its toll of the nerves and nerve and the stamina of the troops. At that time, Churchill was devising a plan to remove the impasse from a Cassino, which through which the road to Rome ran along a valley floor, by planning to land an amphibious force just south of Rome. This was the Operation Shingle, which troops were to be landed at Anzio, only an hour's motoring time from the outskirts of Rome, and by attacking the German supply line on the main road to Cassino to cause Kesselring, the German army commander in Italy, to withdraw his forces from Cassino, which of course would have resulted in the dam breaking and the advance on Rome. For this Operation Shingle, I was nominated the one British press correspondent to land with the invasion forces. There were two other British correspondents, one representing the radio, Winfred Vaughan Thomas, and Basil Gingell, who was representing the agencies. For Anzio, we embarked from the beaches at Salerno in a force which was far too small for the job. But operation was continued nevertheless, despite the lack of landing craft, most of which had been withdrawn for the second front. The Anzio landing took place on a very dark, moonless night on January the 22nd, 1944. I was in the troop ship, or troop transport really, the Glengyle, with a brigade headquarters. I remember the night. As we were anchored, the anchor went down off about 6 miles out from Anzio, which of course we couldn't see. And the ship's pipes summoned us to muster. First it called us to make our peace with God and call his blessing on our enterprise. And we shambled in full battle kit, haversacks on the back and greatcoats on, across the hawsers and ropes on the deck into scramble nets, down which we climbed with difficulty into smaller assault craft, rather like the boats you see coming down water chutes at fairs. The landing craft was jammed tight, so you could only stand up the whole way. The little armada of little ships then set off for the shore, which took some time. Over our heads, the rocket ships fired their quivers of shells on the beach. We could see them landing. It was the first time, by the way, that the rockets were used. From specially improvised barges. As we got nearer the coast, we could see a red light low down on the horizon. This was our aiming point. It had been established there by some naval marines. And as it turned out, it was 200 yards wrong from our real landing place. As we raced for the beach, we suddenly hit ground. The ramp of the landing craft was lowered. The brigadier went first, I went second, and we both sank into something like 20 feet of water. We came up. We were, of course, wearing sausage-like life belts around our middles, and clung on to the front of the ramps. The skipper of the landing craft said, "Hold on." We had hit a sandbank, and he pushed on over it and through, and we landed on the beach. Which was rather a narrow beach and rather full of sandy scrub. I was very wet and helped to haul the pram which carried the signal set further ashore.
The pram?
The pram-like sledge on which this was being hauled. There were mines on the beach, and one or two exploded around us. But we pushed on to the top of the bluff. We were somewhat surprised when, after about a quarter of an hour, no opposing fire came or anything. And we pushed on to the field. All of a sudden, somebody gave the order, "Fix bayonets." A scout ahead had sighted dark shapes in the field. It was still very dark at 2 o'clock in the morning. And we advanced slowly, with trepidation, of course. However, it turned out that these were not Germans, but the remains of the harvest of the previous year, with some stooks of hay still clinging to the wooden poles there. We pushed on further to the lateral road. We had been shown the aerial maps, which gave us a pretty good idea of the location. And we got to the lateral road, and down the road we saw a car approaching with its lights dimmed. We set an ambush in the ditches beside the road, stopped the car, out of which fell five very drunken German soldiers straight into the bag. they made no attempt to fight their way out. We then began to make for the farmhouse, which was supposed to be our rendezvous. And as we got very near the entrance to the farm gate, a German armoured car came racing at us, its guns firing. In fact, it killed a Gordon's officer who was with us, and it turned rather rapidly round the corner, got its wheels stuck in the ditch, but somehow or other managed to get itself out, but then overturned, and we took two Germans prisoner, both in their pyjamas. They had been in their beds when we landed, and we took them with us towards the farm. In the farm, there was a great tureen of soup on the fire. We all got warm and had a nice warming drink. The German beds were very warm. We then waited, and drying as best as we could our clothes. And then a few ranging shots from German guns landed in the farmyard. As light came, however, the Spitfires were overhead, seeking out the German gun positions. The landing, as it said, was a complete success. It was the follow-up that failed to achieve its objective. In the days that followed, the fighting got more and more severe. It was, in fact, said that Anzio, with its hand-to-hand fighting, saw the fiercest fighting since Passchendaele. Wherever you went, there was no refuge in the bridgehead. There were great attacks put in the long wadis alongside, where the dried up streams had been. On the first days, I and Winfried Vaughan Thomas got as far as about 10 miles inland to what was known as the factory at Carochetto. It was to be as far as anybody got in the whole of the siege of Tobruk, siege of Anzio. There again, the Germans attacked and retook it. And later in the siege, the Germans in fact got to within about 3 miles of the port. There was talk then of an evacuation, and Roosevelt spoke in terms of it being another Dunkirk, which of course nettled Churchill, and caused him to blame the war correspondents in the bridgehead. We, of course, were blameless. We would not have, of course, have written anything to suggest that the situation was dire or difficult, and an evacuation of the bridgehead was completely out of the question with something like 50,000 troops there. So the fighting went on until, in fact, it became a stalemate. The censorship continued with the what was known as censorship for policy. That our dispatches, instead of being radioed back to the cable head in Naples, would in fact be censored for other reasons, and had to be sent by ship, which took something like 2 days. As a result, it was the dispatches being written by people at headquarters to the briefings of Allied officers in Caserta that got into the papers, and not our much more detailed and accurate pictures from the bridges itself. I waxed rather angry about this and wrote a polemic from the bridgehead about the fact that the army on these occasions seemed to turn the weapon of propaganda which they had against themselves, and it was shown and established that we were not to be blamed for the despondent reports, as a result of which my editor, Sir Gerald Barry, called a meeting of Empire and Fleet Street editors, waited upon Grigg, the war minister. As a result, we were completely exonerated, and Churchill had the bigness to apologise to me personally in the House of Commons.
When was that?
That was in the February of 1944, that's right, yes. There was one little incident which you may like to know about in the bridgehead when Winfried von Thomas had been given as an experimental tool a new recording machine which was very much in the like of an old-fashioned gramophone with a wind-up gramophone with a wax plate instead of the disc. It wasn't, in fact, very much good, but he was very anxious to try it out. We had made ourselves known to the 1st Reconnaissance Regiment, a Major Ackland, J.A. Ackland, and his other officers, who on one of their meetings with us in the NZO town, where we kept a good mess, told us about the nightingale that sang in the front line. Now, nothing would please Winford but to get this on the record, and he persuaded me to go with him up to the place where the bird sang and to record it. So I helped him to lug this great machine through these wadis up to the firing lines, front line, where we put the machine up under the tree where the bird was said to sing. Nothing happened. So it was this night time, of course. Major Ackland said, would we mind if he started a firefight. He said the birds sang better when this happened. So before we knew where we were keeping our heads down, and a streamer was being fired over our heads, and the nightingale sang. The recording is in the archives of the BBC. I've heard it. Before the end of the Anzio, the touch and go, I was there for the touch and go episodes of Anzio. But at the end of the beginning of April, I was recalled to become one of the News Chronicle team for the Second Front. In the days before the front, before the invasion, it was made known to me that I was to be part of the force that was to attack across Cap Grenet. You can imagine what we felt like. In fact, this was part of the deception plan. And although we didn't, of course, speak about this operation, word was allowed to leak out that this was a possibility. In the end, in the event, didn't land in D-Day. I was attached to the American Third Army, General Patton, and landed with them about 6 days later. The beaches were still a bit under fire with long-range shelling, and we were tucked away in the Cherbourg Peninsula, unoperational, until the breakout plan was put into operation, in which we were to advance down the Avranches line. In the days before we became operative, we did in fact range over the area, trespassed a bit. We had to have copy, or felt we had to have copy, and we took part in the attack on San Lo. I can remember trying to get into San Lo with Cornelius Ryan, the man who wrote The Longest Day, Corny. And as we walked along the road in a dip in the ground, we came under mortar attack. I dived for the ditch, and Ryan fell on top of me, and about a foot from my head was a very dead French peasant in his blue smock coat. So we didn't linger there, and we got out. We went in on another day when the Americans went into the town, and they had the bizarre idea that the first man to get into San Lo should be their commander, who had been killed in the attack on the place, and he was put on a stretcher on the front of a jeep into the village square. Macabre lot, aren't they? in the advance through Avranches, the Avranches Gap, I was able to be the first man to get into Mont Saint-Michel. We'd stopped the night before in a little village called Givet, where, as we slept in our hotel there, the German tanks rumbled through the village, and we, peeping over the sills of our bedrooms, could see them roaring through. Anyway, they got away. Next morning, we found the local fisherman, and he agreed to take us across the Manche, the little estuary there, which is, of course, mined by the Germans with what was referred to as Rommel's asparagus. He knew the quicksands, of which there are many in that area, and taking off our trousers and our boots, of course, we waded across the estuary, a distance of something like 2 or 3 miles to reach the place where we were given an ecstatic welcome. It was pretty well peopled by refugees, but we did take 3 Germans prisoner. They gave themselves up, and we were carried shoulder high to the restaurant, not the famous Madame Poulard's, another, and speeches were made, and champagne was bottles were opened, and there was general glee and rejoicing. At the end of this, I may say that we were in fact given the bill for the champagne. Such are the Normans. We stayed that night in the in Madame Poulard's, and next day, who should join us but Ernest Hemingway, a very raucous, foul-mouthed chap who insulted everybody in the dining room, because of course the refugees were staying there as well.
Why should he want to insult
me? He was drunk, and he was also very gung-ho. He had came back to us with a tale of having been out with the American 4th Division, Cloverleafs, I think they call themselves, fighting with them, which I think was sheer nonsense anyway. Further on, we then, the advance was very rapid. We would find ourselves, because this was the beginning of August, find ourselves racing through towns where the white flags would be out, other places where there weren't any flags. For instance, we got to Le Mans, where we went to the hotel there, put our bedrolls down, and went to the restaurant for a meal. And at the other side of the room were 3 German officers still finishing their meal. We decamped pretty quickly. The next day, it was a question of simply motoring, although we did get into the end of the Falaise battle, which was which a lot of destruction was wrought on the German forces there.
What did you see of Falaise?
Pretty well. I didn't see any fighting as such, but I saw the wreckage, the damage, the horse-drawn carts, the dead horses, that sort of thing. That particular day, I remember, we ran into Patton, whom I found a very able and witty man. We were on the southern end of the Falaise Gap. People have wondered over the years why we didn't capture all the Germans inside they were encircled, or almost encircled. And Patton said, when you get rats in a trap, you don't put them in the sack and close the neck so that they can break out.